Next speaker is Dr. Susan Wong, who is a professor of medicine in the Division of Infectious Diseases at the University of California, Irvine School of Medicine, and the Medical Director of Epidemiology and Infection Prevention at UC Irvine Health. She has some very impressive training, including from Johns Hopkins, the Harvard School of Public Health, and completing her ID fellowship at the combined Harvard program at Brigham and Women's Hospital and Massachusetts General Hospital, which means, of course, that our very own Al DeMaria had to have known her, because Al does seem to know everyone. Her clinical and epidemiologic research has a major focus on multi-drug resistant organisms, identifying the population and the environmental burden, risk factors for acquisition and disease, and preventive strategies for containment. She is the lead investigator on 4 randomized clinical trials on preventing MRSA disease and other healthcare-associated infections. She studies the regional prevention of MDROs in hospitals and nursing homes, as well as has research interest in surgical site infections, outbreak detection, and electronic efficiencies for infection prevention. She serves as a member of the Antibiotic Resistance Working Group for the CDC Board of Scientific Counselors, the Antibiotic Resistance Committee for the Infectious Diseases Society of America, and the Clinical Effectiveness Research Innovation Collaborative of the National Academies of Medicine. Ultimately, her intent is to apply statistical, epidemiologic, and mathematical modeling methods to impact the way we monitor and intervene in the spread of bacterial infectious diseases. I met her for the first time this morning, and she is delightful. And when I was leaving my hotel, actually this morning, I was talking with Marion Kaner from Tennessee. And as many of you know, Dr. Kaner is a wonderful expert in the area of healthcare-associated infections, working at the Tennessee Department of Health. And before I could even ask Marion if she knew Dr. Wong, she immediately volunteered and said, with true Marion enthusiasm, that she is one of my all-time heroes. And since I feel that Marion is one of my heroes, I think we are all in for a real treat this morning. So please welcome Dr. Susan Wong.
Thank you. It is an absolute privilege and honor to be here. This is my first CSTE meeting, and I have long admired all the incredible work that you do, and I'm also a fan of Marion Kaner, of course, so, and Al DeMaria, and all the rest of you who are here who fight the good fight. I'm here to talk to you today about preventing the spread of multidrug-resistant organisms and what regional modeling can actually teach us as we then dive into the real grit of actually doing those types of studies. I do have some disclosures, so the types of studies that I do in hospitals and nursing homes, these particular areas receive contributed products from Sage, Mölnlycke, 3M, and Clorox in order to study some of the questions that we have for interventions. One of the remarkable things about multidrug-resistant organisms is really the inexorable rise that we've seen. Probably every couple of years, a new one comes on the block, and we really are, in many ways, inundated by the sheer number of them that exist today, and all of them, in many ways, persisting and often becoming endemic. And this is just a reminder slide to let us know that it really isn't going away. We may have been making some real gains in reducing disease, but if you look at the prevalence of these organisms that actually exist in the communities and in hospitalized patients, the prevalence really hasn't gone down. And what it tells us is that the opportunity for disease and the opportunity for spread is quite robust. If you look at people who walk into a hospital today, about 5 to 8% of them carry multidrug-resistant Staph aureus. If you look at those who walk into an ICU, it's about twice that number. And if you look at those who walk into long-term care, into nursing homes, it's about 1 in 3, 1 in 4 walk in carrying MRSA. And that's just MRSA, the one that we have the most evidence that exist. And then the studies that we've done in a wide variety of nursing homes, we find that if you look at all multidrug-resistant organisms, MRSA, VRE, gram-negative rods, we're talking on the order of 35 to 45% of them in nursing homes carrying at least one of those multidrug-resistant pathogens. So a really alarming amount of drug resistance and an amazing amount of concentration when we talk about healthcare facilities. And so I wanted to mention how important it is to think about this broadly, this idea that we aren't particularly silos, each hospital, each nursing home, each long-term acute care facility, but in fact we share. And sometimes sharing is not good. So we did some work a while ago, and we continue to do work looking at how much is really shared. So this is my hospital. I'm in Orange County in California. This is where I'm very close to where Disneyland is. And if you look at our hospital here, just listed as a hub, we are one of 32 hospitals in Orange County. Orange County is the sixth largest county in the United States. And if you look at the shaded area, this is known as a spider map. And if you look at the shaded area of the region, those are the areas in which we pull our patients from. So the deeper the color, the deeper the amount of extraction from that area for people who are hospitalized in our center. And all the lines represent our connectivity to the other 32 or 31 hospitals in that area. The darker the line, the more patients we share in a given year. And we can replicate this for any facility in our county, and in fact we had years ago and actually distributed it out to the facilities so they could see exactly who they share with. But it's quite remarkable, and we first thought, well, you know, we're the only tertiary care center in Orange County, and maybe it's all because of that, because we take a lot of referrals and we send them to different places, and maybe it's just because of who we are. And then so we looked at this and we said, okay, let's lay them all out. Let's lay out the 32 hospitals across the x-axis, and let's give every hospital a color. And let's say if we put a patient into an ambulance and we transfer them directly from one hospital to another, we're both aware that we're sharing a patient. How many times does that occur in a given year, hospital by hospital? And you can see that across this graph that maybe 50, 100, 150 patients a year across the board, each hospital is sending that out year by year. And there's a smattering of different colors because they tend to share their patients with different people. And what if we looked at not just the direct ambulance-to-ambulance transfers, but what if we looked at people who went home and then went to another hospital, or people who went to a long-term care facility, assisted living, and then went to another hospital? It looks like this. And so we're talking about 11 times the amount of sharing that's existing between these hospitals when you account for people who have their own will to go wherever they want or to get sick in various places and then go to a different facility than they were before. So the other thing that's remarkable is if you look, and it's probably hard to see, but you'll have to trust me, but let's go back and take a look, for example, at Hospital 12. And if you look at Hospital 12, they'll say, oh, my best friend in this community of hospitals is this turquoise hospital, because that's who I put my patients into the ambulance the most often and send them to that hospital. But if you look at Hospital 12 in this particular graph, what you find is that by far and away their closest hospital is this dark blue hospital. And so you don't even realize who you're sharing the most patients with until you start to really look at a bigger picture of who's coming and who's going. And that's the genesis of the ability to spread, is that we don't even know where our patients are going, we don't even know what they're carrying, and then they're cycling through these hospitals many, many times a year. If you then say, well, you're looking at a year, and how often do we harbor a pathogen for a year? Well, it turns out that you don't have to wait a year, that most of these people who come back into the hospital come back within 30 days. So the median time to turn around is less than a month. Half of all of this sharing is occurring within 4 weeks, and you can imagine there are plenty of pathogens that we harbor for that amount of time. If you look at MRSA alone, the half-life is 6 months in general in hospitalized patients. It's longer in long-term care. That means 50% of people known to harbor MRSA still harbor it 6 months later. So overall, we find that if you are hospitalized in our county, 30% of the time you'll be hospitalized again in the next year. So there's a large amount of comorbidity in the hospital system. And if you get rehospitalized, half the time you go somewhere else. So a huge amount of exchange. And that means that this idea of perfect communication on transfer, while it is absolutely important and absolutely should be done, it will only get a fraction of the pie. So the question is, in addition to that, what else can we do? This is a picture of Orange County, just put a different way. You put all the 32 hospitals around in a grid, all the bigger the box, the bigger the hospital, and we draw one line between them if they share one patient in a year, so very easy to do. And it looks like the perfect spirograph. And if you then change it to 10 patients a year, so still not too bad, it's still pretty confluent, and at 100 patients shared a year, you still see that there are a bunch of lines floating around. And so we really do exchange, and some of those lines connect two different hospitals. So again, you don't always know who you're sharing the most people with. If you put a name to this, a disease, for example, if we take C. diff cases and we say, okay, now let's see how much of this is roaming around Orange County, and this is a while ago now, but we've done it for other diseases since. If you take a look and say, okay, we're not even interested for C. diff in a year. Let's talk about 12 weeks. Let's talk about this 12-week period that people are at risk for recurrence, for example, or that we know that they're still shedding. And let's take a look at 30 days and let's look at 12 weeks. And if you take a look at the graphic you see on the left-hand side, those are all the readmissions happening within 30 days of a diagnosis, and then on the right, 12 weeks after. And these are not to self. So this is not being discharged from one hospital and coming back to that hospital. Everything you see there is to a different facility. And these are only the hospitals. I haven't even put in the nursing homes. So these are studies that we started to do, and others have followed suit, which is really interesting. So this is some really famous modelers that have looked at this both in the UK, so in the London area, and also looking at the Netherlands. And what they did is they took the referral patterns that are well known in the UK among their trusts, which is what they call their hospitals, and then in the Netherlands as well. And they could prove that their setup for referral really allows for a much more rapid spread of, in this case, multidrug-resistant organisms in the UK than it would in the Netherlands simply because of the way in which their healthcare is structured. So they found that an average English hospital shares about 4,000 patients with other facilities, and an average Dutch hospital about a third of that. And their conclusion was the same as we all know, which is that we can't exist as silos. It's very rare to have a facility that really doesn't interact very much with other facilities around them. And we really need to think about ourselves and the way that we can impact prevention by looking at us as a full network. And of course, this resonates perfectly with what all of you have been saying and CDC has been saying for a very long time. That, and those of us like myself who oversee a healthcare infection prevention program, we tend to be very, very restricted in our view, but we need to be much broader. So what if we add in the nursing homes? So here we go. Red is the hospitals. Yellow, long-term acute care facilities. Green, all of the freestanding nursing homes in Orange County. And you draw one line between them for a patient shared in a given year, 10 patients shared, and 100 patients shared. And here you can see that not only between the hospitals do they share patients they don't know about, but of course you can imagine between long-term care. And we haven't even put in assisted living. You can imagine the amount of exchange that can occur. And then let's put, again, organisms to this. So we decided that we would take all of the people who came through my hospital who had a positive culture for MRSA, so those who either acquired it at our hospital or those who were passing through, were already known to have it, and we took everybody who we knew had a positive culture. That way nobody could say, well, they may not be positive anymore, we keep the flag up. So they were known positive, and we followed them for a year. So we took a five-year period, and every time someone went through our hospital, we tracked them for a year, and we said, now where are they exposing other facilities to MRSA? And in this particular setup, you can see that across a five-year period, what you're seeing is a map of California. The bottom big red dot, that's where Orange County is, just north of it, L.A. County, just south of it, San Diego County. And that's that huge, large, enlarging blob over time. And then take a look at where San Francisco County is. And you can start to see that in those areas, you start to see many, many different dots appearing. And that's because people tend to move and go to various places for care, or they go on vacation. medication, and so forth. So what we found is that my hospital, just by letting people traffic through who have MRSA, they in the next year will expose 137 hospitals and 103 nursing homes to MRSA. And this occurs in 103 cities and 14 counties throughout the state. And this amounts to nearly 20,000 hospital days of exposures and nearly 40,000 nursing home days of exposure, just as they're moving through. And imagine if we had done this for all the hospitals in California and where we move all of our patients in a given year. We can do this for other things. Again, MRSA has the most data, but we can do it for C. diff, we can do it for VRE, we can do it for ESBL, and you can see that the picture is very, very similar. A huge enlarging circle around the three major counties in Southern California and then extending into Northern California. So it raises a lot of questions about regional control, and many of these you have done or you've experienced or you've heard about. So, of course, the CDC's Emerging Infections Program and a remarkable amount of national surveillance, really detail-oriented work, huge amounts of outlay of effort, both from the laboratory and from, of course, the Emerging Infections Program that do this. The Realm Project out of Chicago, a tremendous amount of work there, working with long-term care as well as ICUs and nursing homes, and developing a remarkable registry to be able to exchange information between healthcare facilities. Ohio did a very large C. diff initiative, Oregon, a really impressive, well-known CRE initiative. And we've done initiatives with Orange County, both for Project MAP, which is largely a survey, surveillance, swabbing type of activity, now moving into an intervention activity through something known as Shield Orange County. And one of the things that we learn as we do these types of regional interventions is the tremendous amount of effort that it takes. It takes a true amount of effort, amount of coordination. It is incredibly labor intensive. And if you actually want to measure and monitor an impact, it's even more effort than it is just to do the intervention itself. And so one of the things that we wanted to do is to think about how we can model, how can we simulate, and think about how that might help us target the types of interventions that we want to do. Regional interventions really ask and answer generally one major question. That's true for most research studies. That's true definitely for research trials. And it only provides, in general, one big answer, sometimes a few side ones, but largely one big answer. And it takes years, years to have things happen, years to see an impact. Behavior is hard to change. And so what we can do is if we create a simulation and if we really embed it, so I am primarily, first and foremost, like many of you, an epidemiologist. My interest is in data, solid data that we can load in. And I've been trained by some of the best mathematical modelers, largely with my intent to parlay with them. So we can speak the same language, so we can talk about the things that are going into the model, so we can make the models make the most sense for us, and that we can test different things and understand what's coming back out at us. So we decided to build a model of Orange County. And Orange County is a really nice place to model because of some of the data sets that exist, many of which exist for your states as well, and because it's fairly large. So again, we have about 3.1, 3.2 million people. Again, it's the sixth largest county. Bordering us is the fifth largest county, which is San Diego, and then LA County at the top of the list right above us. We have about 320,000 admissions in the hospital system each year, and it's quite circumscribed. So again, water to the left, the forest to the right, Camp Pendleton to the south, and then the worst barrier, LA traffic, to the north, and nobody in their right mind seeks regular care across that border. So we are quite circumspect, and when we look circumscribed, and when we look at this, about 85% of people who live in Orange County seek hospital care within Orange County. So we partnered with Bruce Lee, who is an amazing mathematical modeler and a physician who's now at Hopkins, he used to be at Pittsburgh, and developed an agent-based model. So he and his team developed an agent-based model, and we used our data from Orange County to populate as much as we could. And this agent-based model, the agent is the person, and so basically it's like a sim city. It allows these people to move around between the different facilities, and you can track them, and you know how long they stay, and it does, and you can give them characteristics. And so you can, if you wanted to, you can give them an age characteristic, you can give them a carrier characteristic, how many carry MRSA, for example, and also comorbidities. So our model, and I'm just going to hum this with you because it's not worth anything other than a distant picture, but we have this model. And these people, we know a lot of detail about them, and we know it because of the state inpatient databases. So many of these databases exist for your state, and they basically are mandatory hospital discharge data that has to be provided to the state. It tells how many go through a facility, regardless of their insurance. They could be homeless. They could have no insurance. It still is reported. It tells them how long they stay. It gives them certain characteristics in terms of administrative data, coded data for comorbidities. So we can move them through ICUs and non-ICUs. We've done surveys of Orange County hospitals to understand how many go through where, and we actually use real length of stay data. So using these databases, as they move through the facilities, we can say, okay, well, we know how many move through facility X in a given year, and we know the actual distribution of how long they stay, and we can mimic that exact distribution, and we know how many are directly transferred. And when they're directly transferred, we can create a real matrix of where they tend to go after they leave that exact hospital. And then we can ask the question, how many of them don't go straight, but they're readmitted within a year? And how long does it take for them to get readmitted? And we can mimic that exact distribution of time outside of the facility and then return them into the system at the same, with a different matrix of where they tend to go when they come back. So we have a real variety of different data sources that come in. And some of it has been done with our surveys, but I'll say that there are two databases that have been extremely useful that are accessible to all of you. And those databases are, again, your state inpatient database. The CDC has done some really nice outreach, I think, to all of the state departments offering Medicare data that gives you a very, very large portion of the patients and the movement, probably more than half of them using Medicare and Medicaid data. And the other group is what you can get through Medicare, known as the minimum data set. And that particular data is for nursing homes. And nursing homes who take even one dime from Medicare have to report on every single resident that's in that facility. And so, again, it gives a very complete picture of patients who go into licensed nursing homes and how long they stay and for what reason. And then with some nice mapping and fuzzy logic, we're actually able to link those data sets and then mimic where people go. So I'm going to get us through just a few kind of premises. So what can we learn? Because not everyone's going to go and create this big model, but there are a few things that we can do simply and a few things that we can let you know about what we found. So the first thing is localized outbreak. We can force an outbreak in this model in any facility. And what is consistent when we do that is that there's always about 4 or 5 other facilities, hospitals, that are affected. And if you take a look at this, so the big peak is the forced outbreak, and then all the different colors. Remember, we gave each hospital a different color. And so you can start to see that 4 other hospitals experience a little peak. And what is remarkable is it doesn't happen right away. It happens about 3 or 4 months, 5 months, 6 months later. And it's because of the time that it takes people to go out of the hospital and then return. And if you don't know that they're a carrier, you could have pseudo-outbreaks. You could assume that it's your facility that's actually generating these cases. Or you may not know to isolate them because we have incomplete knowledge and incomplete communication. So this is a very consistent thing that we see, 4 or 5 hospitals being affected by a single hospital outbreak in Orange County. Same thing, hospitals can affect nursing homes. And the impact to their prevalence is much higher because they're smaller. So now you get a handful of 5 people who come through, and obviously 5 out of 100 is a much greater proportion, or 5 out of 50 compared to a hospital of 200, 300, or 400 beds. And so we find the same thing, that you can routinely find 4 other nursing homes, sometimes 5, sometimes 10, that have an appreciable jump in their prevalence just because one hospital has an outbreak. And same thing, vice versa, no surprise, nursing homes can affect hospitals in very much the same way. They have a nursing home outbreak, and then off it goes to their closest neighbor or their closest partner, and then you start to see a rise, generally between 3 to 5 other nursing homes being affected. And so one of the things that we learned about outbreak control is if you're aware of your outbreak, you have a little bit of time, meaning your ability to impact an outbreak is longer than you think. The fact that you have these trickle-down effects that go out for 3, 6, 8 months means that getting the word out actually can be quite helpful. And if we were a little bit more willing to be named and let our partners be aware that we're having an issue, sometimes we, you know, willingly reach out and ask if anybody else is having an issue. But most of the time, we feel relatively cloistered and we don't want anybody to be well aware that we're struggling with something. So I think that is a cultural phenomenon that really does need to change. And that's where getting this sense from CDC on the Medicare data, or if you have a tight rapport with your state inpatient database, you can actually do some really nice things to figure out who is everybody's closest partner. And that's who you can reach out to if an outbreak were to occur. What about something that's not as punctate as an outbreak? What about endemic diseases? So now we're talking about MRSA, VRE, things that are kind of out there, and really every facility has it. And what can we do about this? So when we talk about regional interventions, there's so many questions that can be asked that simulation can help with. First of all, who should be the target audience? Should we do something in ICUs only because they're the sickest? Should we do it in long-term care? Should we do it in the whole hospital? Or is it just a combination of ICU and long-term care? All of these things we don't know well, and they have different resources and different people who have to pay for these types of interventions. Also, what should be done? We can model and simulate a whole bunch of things, a combination of screening and contact precautions, interfacility communication. What if you dialed it up and dialed it down? What if you just made compliance super high? Would that make a difference? And what about something like changing your bath soap and doing decolonization with antisepsis? And then also, in addition to who's the target population, which facilities? Maybe the answer is, well, we don't have that many resources. We can only go to three facilities. Who should they be? Maybe we should just think about, you know, we only have the resources to have a half of an FTE who's going to do this. They can only concentrate on 10 facilities. Which facilities should they be? And also really important is, how long do we need to wait to see results? And that's one of the things we've learned from modeling, is that it takes a while. So you might be toiling and toiling. You might have hired someone for a year, and they don't see a difference after a year of a whole lot of toiling. And you think, oh, this is a waste. But if you really understood that the models show that at about 18 months you start to dive, and that there's a lag time in all of this effort to kind of not just take up the intervention, but then to actually apply it and then to see the fruits of your labor, you would realize that we're talking about a multi-year benefit if you can actually just get things off the ground. So these types of time horizons become really important to understand. This is, again, a reminder slide to say that we modeled a bunch of different things, but in the case I'm about to show you, we said, okay, let's look at active surveillance. So this would be, what if we screened people who were directly transferred? Again, the small piece of the pie, direct transfers from acute care facilities and from long-term care, and screened them, in this case, for MRSA. And everybody who has MRSA, either from screen or just from prior knowledge, gets put into contact precautions, which is where providers wear gowns and gloves and appropriately wash their hands before and after seeing a patient. And this is the remarkable thing that you'll see. So I'll help walk you through it because it's a confusing graph. So the top row, single hospital campaigns. In our model, we took hospitals one by one. We allowed them to do contact precautions and screening all by themselves in this one and held everybody else constant. And you can see when you do that, the hospital who's doing the intervention benefits by about a 12% decrease in MRSA prevalence. And these are real prevalence. We actually went out and did a whole lot of measurement, collected a whole bunch of strains. So these are fairly robustly embedded data points from epidemiologic studies. And that results in about a 71-person prevention each hospital each year from acquiring MRSA in our county. And what if you said, okay, we don't have, we want to do better than having one hospital in our entire system, no matter who it is, do something. What if we took the sixth largest hospital? And what you find is that, of course, they get the benefit. Everyone who does the intervention derives the most benefit. But take a look. All of a sudden, the people who aren't doing anything, the people who are just kind of, hey, we call this a free ride. These other hospitals are doing absolutely nothing, but they see about a 2% reduction in their MRSA. And overall, six of their patients who would have picked up MRSA actually don't. 10 largest hospitals, again, these free rider hospitals, the other 21 hospitals in the county, or 22 hospitals in the county, deriving some benefit. And the last one, if you do all hospitals in the county do the same thing, you can see that their gain is about 16% instead of the 12% that they would have gotten alone. And so one of the things that we've been trying to urge people to understand is that you can gain so much more together than you can working alone. And that's because these things are contagious and because we share patients. And so the more we can think about public health encouraged institutional interventions, I think the more gains that we can eventually have. This is a slide that suggests that for those of you who are really down on an intervention because uptake is low, this just reminds us that you can actually get relative gains for any amount of improvement in compliance. So in this case, we're talking about contact precautions, probably one of the most poorly adhered to things in hospitals, which is getting your gown on, washing your hands, and doing it properly before you put on gloves and after. And what we find in general in the literature is it's probably done right maybe 40% of the time, maybe 40 if you're lucky, 60% of the time. And a lot of people say, well, that's a reason to just can it all together because nobody does it well, not many people do it right all the time, and across human behavior, it's a mess. But the truth is, if you actually move from 25% compliance to 45% compliance or 45% to 65%, you will have a really noticeable difference across a region. And so it's just a reminder that anything that you do, just being owning where it starts and moving it along that pathway can be quite remarkably helpful wherever you can start. I'll skip that. So here's another thing that we learned about within the model. And what we learned is that nursing homes do contact precautions in a very different way than acute care hospitals for very good reasons. The nursing home is a home, and we don't want it to be stigmatized, and we don't want it to seem like they can't interact and they can't have friends just because they're colonized. So one of the things that we found in nursing homes is that the guidance that's given to them is if you are draining and you can't really contain it, then you should apply contact precautions. But in general, if you're just a known carrier and you're shedding, you don't necessarily need to. And that makes, in my mind, again, good sense for the nursing homes, but it fails to get them to think about, okay, if I don't do contact precautions, what else can I do? Because the failure of contact precautions or the failure to use it really has a sizable impact. And I continue to teach in our county that what else are you doing then if you're not doing what some of these hospitals are doing, something that has been shown to be pretty effective. So this particular graph needs a little bit of explanation. At the dotted line is when we institute both hospital and nursing home contact precautions. So we kind of feed in the model or let it run, and then we institute what we think is already happening. And there are three lines there. You can't tell that there are three lines coming off of that graph because two of them are superimposed. And we looked at three things that nursing homes could do. One, no contact precautions at all. Do nothing. Number two, if someone's infected, which is not that often, put them in contact precautions for 10 days, assuming that they're shedding or whatever they're doing. And the third one is do what the hospitals do, which we know won't happen. But we just wanted to see what the splay in the graphs would be. And what you find is at the very top, it doesn't matter if you do nothing or you just do the infected. And it's largely because those who are colonized shed so profusely. So this is, again, for MRSA. The gram-positives shed a tremendous amount into the environment. Really nice data that whether you're infected or colonized, you will shed equally onto providers' coats, onto providers' hands, and onto the environment in the proximal environment around the patient. So, again, this is a real wake-up call to us that nursing homes need to think of something else, something along the lines of better cleaning, on the lines of decolonization, something that's kind of embedded in their workflow. And that leads to some of the activities that we're doing in Orange County. This is another thing that we've also learned is that we can see the value of certain targets. So as you know, there have been lots of trials in hospitals that have looked at bathing with chlorhexidine in the ICU setting. And in this setting, we and others have found that we can drop MRSA in the ICU setting by 37% just by swapping out the bathing soap, making it a chlorhexidine-based regimen and decolonizing the nose. And we can drop bloodstream infections in the ICU by about half. By just doing that, by swapping out the soap and giving them some nasal decolonization. But what's really remarkable is that if you take a look at this, it doesn't go very far. We were really hoping, oh, if we just decolonized all of the ICU patients, the uptake in the United States today after those trials is about 70% of ICUs in the United States, 70% of hospitals in the United States use chlorhexidine in at least one ICU. So that is a huge uptake after trials that came out in 2013. And what you can see is that there are a bunch of lines. The top line always is the place that's doing it. So the top line is the gain due to the ICUs. They see the greatest benefit. The one right under it is total hospital, which is largely the ICU benefit. And then everything under that is the non-ICU, the nursing home, the long-term acute care setting. And so what it reminds us is that we have to know the influence that our target populations have. And we have done studies now, trials in the non-ICU that just closed and is entering into the analysis phase and should be out hopefully late next year. We're moving into nursing home trials, and we've done some post-discharge trials that will be out hopefully at ID Week later this year that talks about the scope and the breadth of interventions in other places. So emerging diseases, what about this real interest, of course, that we all have in CRE, carbapenem-resistant bacteriaceae? And here's data from Orange County that shows that moved from east to west, as many things do, landed in Orange County in late 2009, and then doubled every year since. And it's really a remarkable response that you'll see across the hospitals, because most hospitals will either say, oh, yes, I saw my first case. Some of them will be extremely concerned, lots of screening, thinking about what we can do to mobilize, and the others will say, well, it's one case, why don't I just wait until it really is a problem? So it's a wide variation in concern. We built a CRE model, again, lots of epidemiologic data, lots of thinking about what types of parameters to use, but we basically retooled our Orange County model to be able to simulate CRE. And this is a reminder of the CDC vital signs report that I'm sure you're all aware of, this idea that we need to work together. What can we do? And we can show that coordinated responses are better than individual responses. So in the MMWR to the left, that's the data done by Matt Seymour in Utah in 10 facilities. Our data on the right in Orange County with over 100 facilities, acute and long-term care, and basically showing that you can blunt the CRE spread quite substantially. That bottom line is doing a coordinated approach. That is, if public health said, galvanized all the facilities and said, no, we're not going to wait until you declare you're concerned. We're going to tell you when to become concerned. We're going to tell you that now we have 5 hospitals, 10 hospitals, 15 hospitals in the county that have CRE, and we're all going to act and do something. In this case, the particular thing we were looking at here is not only good communication, also looking at contact precautions and then some limited screening of people on transfer. So in hospitals, and these scales, I'll warn you, are not the same. So the only thing is just to look at the relative reduction. The lowest two lines are if public health decides to intervene in 2 different time points, 5 hospitals in the county positive versus 10, versus at the top, all the different ones where you wait for 10, 15, 30% of the hospitals to start to care and to do something different. So hospitals blunting of an effect, long-term acute care where a lot of it lives, and then, of course, nursing homes, same thing. So this idea that you can get a lot more if you have the facilities in an area do the same thing together. And the last thing that I'll say about regional interventions for emerging diseases is that earlier is better. And it is very hard to galvanize early because the numbers are small. And you have to find something that people are willing to do when they know that their ability to affect something is a small proportion of the outlay of the work. So I'm going to put a plug for something that also works for other things, and that's part of the reason why I'm a big decolonization advocate, because not only would it work for the emerging disease, but it can work substantially for endemic diseases, and you can get kind of a two-pronged benefit. But if you start late, you're late in the game, and it takes you a lot more many years to get back to where you could have been if you had started early. So overall, these are the insights that, you know, regional studies can affect regional interventions, that you can focus on what your validation scale should be. Is it hospitals? Is it nursing homes? Is it a combined one? You can hone the intervention that you want to study. You can check your sample size, how long you need to go, how long you need to wait to see the fruits of your labor, and understand the uncertainties. And the public health insights that I just mentioned, endemic diseases, big facilities, well-connected facilities, you don't even need a model, you just know. Those big ones that are well-connected, it's a good place to start if you have low resources. Localized, if you have an outbreak, you need to know. You need to figure out the interconnectedness in the areas that you serve. And the emerging ones, again, earlier better than late, together public health coordinated effort to urge people to be concerned. And we've done surveys that really suggest that hospitals are basically doing contact precautions for CRE, not much else, but they're willing to do more. What's remarkable in Orange County is they all say, well, if you really wanted to do a regional control effort, we'll be up for doing a couple of those things, those extra things. It's just that nobody ever asks. And they're more willing to do it because it's rare. So if you say, fine, decolonize those that you find, they're like, sure, it's a couple a year, or it's, you know, 10 a year, 20 a year, 50 a year, it's not that bad. So we just need to think about what we can do to ask. And I'll end by talking about two slides or three slides on what is Shield Orange County. As I mentioned, we spent years measuring swabbing, showing that the strains that we collected mimic the pathways that patients take. And finally, we got some really nice funding from CDC to actually do the intervention and to prove that regional interventions can do a lot more than solo activities alone. So what we did is we took Orange County, we took all of our models, and we said, okay, let's do a regional intervention. Which one should we do? We modeled a whole bunch of stuff, and we thought if we're going to target CRE and MRSA, decolonization would be really nice to do. It's the only intervention that affects people who already have it. It doesn't just prevent new people from acquiring it, but it actually reduces the burden on people who already have it. And we found the 40 most networked facilities in our group, the hospitals and the nursing homes, and through an incredible partnership with Lynn Jansen at the California Department of Public Health and Matt Zahn at the county, we are together with CDC going to launch an intervention to decolonize certain high-risk groups in that area, patients in contact precautions in hospitals, and swap out the entire SOAP system in long-term acute care and the nursing homes that are participating. And this will occur early next year and hopefully measuring a good amount of change in our multi-drug resistant organisms as a result. In conclusion, I'm really pleased to kind of work with all of you in thinking about this idea of public health, broader connectivity, this idea that patient sharing is everywhere, and that unless we can prove otherwise, we should assume that the facilities in our networks that are relatively close to one another are sharing a large volume of patients. They share in the positive benefits of interventions and the negative effects of outbreaks. And it's really in our best interest to figure out how they're shared. And models, when you have the ability to do them, can give us some of these pointers to figure out what are the best interventions that we can do. So a million people need to be thanked for all of the data that I showed. But again, just thanks to CSTE, the board, and to Aldea Maria, who invited me to come and speak with you.